In the name of God, most merciful, most compassionate. Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be back in Fresno after a couple of months. I was asked tonight to talk about mysticism, as I had made references to this term in my past lectures. Mysticism is truly the spiritual essence of all the religions in the world. It is not an independent school of thought. It is rather a perspective on religion. It is a unique appreciation of the teachings of religion. It is a type of religiosity. There are scholars who believe that mysticism can exist outside religion. It is true. It possibly can. However, for all intent and purposes, from a practical standpoint, the most famous mystics have risen out of world religions. Their teachings have been rooted in religious traditions. All major world religions, including Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism, have mystical traditions. Some are stronger than others. Some are more popular and more well-known than the others, but nonetheless, all true and authentic religions of the world have mystical traditions. And personally, I think if a school of thought does not have mysticism in it, we cannot call it a religion, because it would be devoid of spirituality. Judaism is often known as a rule-based religion. In other words, there seems to be a disproportionate emphasis on religious rules and observances. Even though Judaism is overloaded with formalities, still it has a mystical tradition known as Kabbalah. From the very outset, Judaism did have mystics, not too many of them, but they were around. However, in the 12th and 13th century AD, Kabbalah was developed to a great extent, and today Jewish mystics follow Kabbalah. Christianity, in contrast to Judaism, does not have any rules governing diet, hygiene, prayers, the economy, or politics. It is more concerned with the issue of man's personal and immediate encounter with God. So, of all the religions in the Abrahamic traditions, mysticism comes very natural to Christianity. You don't have to bend forward and backward to justify mysticism within the Christian tradition. And the reason for that is because you do not find a lot of observances, or what we call in Arabic Shari'at, in Christianity. We do not have jurisprudence or fiqh in Christianity. So because of that, mysticism comes very natural to Christianity. Interestingly enough, however, Western Christianity does not have a very strong mystical tradition. Western Christianity, in other words, Catholicism and Protestantism, has always been more interested in rationalistic theology. In other words, Western Christian theologians have been spending most of their time developing doctrines and dogma. It is Eastern Orthodox Christianity that has a very strong mystical tradition. Even things such as doctrine of Trinity, incarnation, and the original sin within the Eastern Orthodox tradition has a mystical twist in it. Islam is truly the middle of the road. It sits right in between Christianity and Judaism. It does have a strong emphasis on the spirituality, and at the same time it has some strong observances and rules that Muslims should follow. And much of the Islamic mysticism is encapsulated in a school called Sufism. Sufis throughout history have contributed the most to Islamic mysticism. A word of caution though, not all Muslim mystics are Sufis. Most are, but not all of them. You do not have to be a Sufi in order to practice Islamic mysticism. Now, mysticism is the most authentic form of Muslim spirituality. You see, in our fiqh or jurisprudence, there is no spiritual element to it, contrary to what most people think. Authentic Islamic spirituality exists in Islamic mystic tradition. Up until the 18th century or so, mysticism was the dominant perspective in the Islamic world. In the past two centuries, however, Muslim theologians have made a shift towards a more rationalistic and philosophical approach to Islam. As I mentioned, mysticism is a perspective. It is not a religion unto itself. It is not independent of world religion. If I were to pick five or six important principles that the mystic perspective embraces, it would be the following. Perhaps the most important emphasis in mysticism is on the inner life of the faithful. We all have an outer life that we share with other people, and we have an inner life that only we are aware of, and God. Mystics tend to focus on the inner life of the faithful. The second important principle would be the supremacy of the heart over the mind. Thirdly, the inner meanings of religious practices and prayers. Jurists in Islam and Judaism in particular, they don't pay much attention to the philosophy and the spirit of religious rules, observances, and practices. Mystics, on the other hand, put the spotlight on the inner meanings of these rituals, rites, and practices. Fourthly, spirituality and ethical behavior forms the foundation of the mystical perspective. Number five, pluralism is very important in mysticism. Pluralism in theology basically means that there are many diverse paths to God. All of these paths are valid and authentic. No religion has monopoly over the truth. No set of religious doctrines can possibly encapsulate and embrace God. And lastly, you will find a great deal of emphasis on religious tolerance in mysticism. Mystics, by nature, are extremely tolerant folks. Anyhow, in tonight's lecture, I will share with you an introduction to mysticism. Obviously, mysticism covers a vast expanse of literature. It is next to impossible to do justice to it in one lecture. However, I'm going to elaborate to some extent on three or four important principles of mysticism that I shared with you a few minutes ago. I want to remind you again that everything that I say tonight equally applies to all mystic traditions in the world. I'm going to use examples from the Islamic tradition, but by no stretch of imagination, it is not limited to Islam. You could equally apply it to Judaism, to Christianity, Buddhism, and so forth. But since this is an Islamic cultural center, and most of you may be Muslims, I'm going to use examples from Islamic tradition. What does mysticism mean? Let's start off with that. What does the word mysticism itself mean? In Arabic and Farsi, we have a term called irfan, which comes from the root word ma'rifat, or in English, knowledge. Irfan is a type of knowledge blended with love. Knowledge we typically associate with the mind, reason, and rationality. Imagine for a sec that it would be possible to blend reason with love. If you could ever mix the two and create knowledge out of that, that would be Irfan. In other words, the knowledge that Irfan embodies is confirmed by the intellect. The knowledge is reasonable. It does make sense. However, it transcends reason. It goes beyond the intellect and rationality. It does not solely rest on formal logic the way philosophy does. Irfan is usually translated into English as mysticism. Now, what does mysticism mean? Myth, mysticism, and mystery, all three of them come from the same Greek root, myein, M-Y-E-I-N. That's a Greek term. Myein means to close the eyes and the mouth. This is very critical. To close the eyes and the mouth. All three words, myth, mysticism, and mystery, are rooted in an experience of darkness and silence. In the Abrahamic tradition, in other words, in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, God engages humanity. He addresses human beings by means of dialogue. Not silence. It's a dialogue that God has with humanity. God utters a word, and that word becomes the focus of devotion and attraction. Then humanity is supposed to ponder the meaning of the word spoken by God in the flawed and tragic circumstances of earthly life. In other words, the word does not originate from below. It originates from on high. It descends down low. Now, the critical thing is to make sense of something which does not come from this world. It is a struggle that all religious folks across time and space have had to deal with. How to make sense of a word coming from outside this world. Anyhow, Mayin implies silent contemplation. Now, those of you who have read and studied comparative religion, silent contemplation comes very natural to Buddhism, right? That's what yoga is all about and all the other exercises that they have. Contemplation in the Buddhist tradition is really focusing on the divine by drawing inward. In the Abrahamic tradition, we really don't have much silent contemplation. We have prayers, like Muslims, when they pray, they usually talk to God. Have you thought about that? We talk. The God of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism can be talked to. Buddhist notion of God is not like that. You do not talk to God. You realize God in yourself. And it's a major distinction between the two paradigms. Anyhow, the notion that mysticism comes from the root word mayin, and mayin means silent contemplation, can shed some light on the goal that mystics have. The mystic goal cannot be reached by the intellect or argumentation. Let me repeat. The goal that mystics have, which is to unite with God, cannot be reached by the intellect or argumentation. As you will find out later, the road to God is through heart, not intellect. That is a fundamental difference between philosophy and mysticism. Now, in the context of Western spirituality, the word mysticism captures Christianity's perception of God as the ultimate mystery. It is one of the fundamental principles in Christian theology that God is a mysterious entity. Early Christian ascetics invented the term mysticism to identify a knowledge that was related to mysteries, including the ultimate mystery, which is God. In modern times, mystery is not a very flattering and sexy term. Mystery in modern times usually involves obscurity, strangeness, and cloudy thinking, something that requires to be cleared up. That's what we mean by mystery these days. However, when Christians talk about mystery, they're not talking about obscurity and strangeness. What they're talking about is reference to an ineffable reality. What does ineffable mean? Ineffable means something that cannot be fully comprehended by reason and rational inquiry. Ineffable refers to something that cannot be spoken and expressed in ordinary language. That's where perplexity comes into being. Perplexity doesn't mean confusion. Perplexity means being confronted with a reality. You appreciate it, you feel it, but you cannot express it to others. God in the Christian tradition is ineffable, cannot be fully comprehended by reason, cannot be spoken and expressed in ordinary language. So basically this is the meaning of the word mysticism then. Let's talk about and review the first important principle in the mystic tradition, which is the significance of the heart in the spiritual development. You see, in modern times, we are conditioned to view comprehension and understanding exclusively as a product of mind and reasoning. We tend to view knowledge as attainable exclusively through rational inquiry and thought processes. There is an exclusivity embedded in modern knowledge. Muslim mystics challenge this simplistic approach to comprehension and knowledge. When we talk about knowledge of the divine or knowledge of God, according to mystics, you cannot exclusively rely on your intellect and reasoning power. You have to transcend that. In their opposition to this simplistic approach to comprehension and knowledge, Muslim mystics are inspired by the Quran. In chapter 17, there is a discussion about the fact that everything that exists in the universe praises God. Everything celebrates the glory of God. And when the Quran uses the term everything, it includes inanimate objects, rocks, trees, air. It includes birds, cats, and dogs. The question is, how do dogs and cats, trees, and air praise God? Is this Quranic instruction confirmable by reason and the intellect? That's really what the question is. Let me read verse 44 from chapter 17 to you. The seven heavens and the earth and all beings therein declare His glory. There is nothing that does not celebrate His praise nor declare His glory. And yet, you do not understand how they declare His glory. We mortals, insofar as we use our five common senses, are not capable of understanding this cosmic praise of the Lord. As if the entire universe forms a chorus and an orchestra, everything and every organism in the universe sings along and plays on. Every organism plays a part in this cosmic orchestra according to the Quran. Now, if one is deaf, chances are she will not be able to appreciate the music. Would she? If somebody is deaf, chances are he or she cannot appreciate the music. The Quran then shares with us a great insight. وَجَعَلْنَا عَلَىٰ قُلُوبِهِمْ أَكِنَّةٍ أَنْ يَفْقَهُوهُ. And we put a shield around their hearts to prevent them from understanding. What is so out of the ordinary about this verse? Did you catch it? The Quran associates understanding to heart. That is counterintuitive. That's not the way modern folks look at knowledge. The Quran specifically, it associates قلوبهم to أن يفقهوه, understanding with heart. The Quran obviously is suggesting that the heart is not only capable of emotions, affection, and love, but it is also capable of affirming the truth. In other words, there are truths in the world, including truths about the divine, that ultimately the heart can appreciate and confirm. Rumi, the great Iranian Muslim mystic, and the rest of the mystics in the Islamic world go to a great length to elaborate on this Quranic insight. These mystics introduced the concept of ishraq, meaning intuition. Intuition is a sort of knowledge about God acquired through the heart. It's a type of knowledge revealed to the heart. There is a sort of knowledge that is revealed to the mind, and yet there is knowledge that can be revealed to the heart. With no exceptions, God's prophets, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, peace be upon all of them, benefited greatly from intuition. There is no prophet in the Abrahamic tradition who was not blessed and gifted with intuition. A question that has preoccupied theologians for ages is what separates us from God. We all want to get close to God. We all want to experience God. The question is, what is the source of the separation of man from God? What deters us from contacting God? Philosophers answered this question by pointing to lack of proper knowledge about God. The reason man is separated from God, the reason man turns his and her back to God, has to do with the fact that humanity does not have the proper knowledge about God. Those who do not have the facts, the ignorant, will turn their backs to God. The culprit is a mind devoid of knowledge and information. For mystics, the culprit is not ignorance as the disease of the mind. The culprit are the diseases of the heart. Let me give you some examples. Arrogance, self-absorption, hypocrisy, hatred, greed, envy, wickedness, so on and so forth. These are diseases of the heart. As long as we suffer from these diseases, we will be forever separate from God. You can pray all your life and never approach God if these evils exist in your heart. You can go to Hajj every year and not find God there, as long as these vices reside in your heart, according to Muslim mystics. Therefore, when these diseases, these vices, these evil fill our heart, there is no room for God. A pure heart devoid of these vices is a requirement for any divine encounter. It's a prerequisite. It is a requirement. One of God's beautiful names in the Holy Quran is Al-Haq, meaning the truth. That's one way Allah reveals Himself to the rest of the world, by way of being the truth. Let me ask you these questions. Can a hypocrite see the truth? Can a liar report the truth? Can an arrogant submit to the truth? The answer to all these questions is absolutely no. The same holds true for the rest of the vices. Each vice erects a barrier between us and God. The more of these vices we have in our heart, the thicker the wall that would separate us from God. Many of the ethical commands and observances in religion are simple exercises to combat our love of vices. Those exercises are meant to purify and cleanse the heart. That is basically the ultimate aim of mortification in Buddhism, in Sufism, and other spiritual disciplines. And by the way, mortification in Farsi means riyazat. That's what riyazat is all about in Sufism. It is not to make life intolerable for us. These are just exercises that can help us kick the vices out of our heart. Let me give you another story, which is a sort of funny one, from Rumi in Masnavi. In the book 2 of Masnavi, Rumi tells us the story of a Sufi called Bayazid Bastami. He used to live in the northern part of Iran some 1,000 years ago. Now, Bayazid once decided to go to the annual pilgrimage of Hajj. He got up and made the journey towards Mecca. Bayazid was a Sufi, so in every city that he stopped at, he sought the Sufi master that was in that city to talk to and gain some knowledge and wisdom from the master. Once he entered a town and met one of these Sufi masters, the master asked Bayazid where he was going. Hajj, Bayazid responded. And then the master asked him, how much money do you have? Obviously, Bayazid was bewildered. What sort of question is this? Nonetheless, he was obliged to respond. He said, Gof daram az diram nukre devist nak debaste sakht bar gushe ye radist. Bayazid said, I have 200 dinars of money. Then the Sufi master told Bayazid, Gof tufi kon begardam haft bar vin nekutar az tawafe hajj shumar. The Sufi master said, you don't have to go through the trouble of going to Mecca. I make it easy for you. Give me half of your money and make the 7 rounds around me. Well, according to Rumi, that's exactly what Bayazid did. He understood what the Sufi master was talking about. So he paid half of his money to the master, made 7 rounds around the master, and went back home. The Sufi master told Bayazid that if Abraham built Kaaba with clay and stone as the house of God, my heart is also the house of God. Yet there is one difference, one crucial difference. تا بکردان خانه را در وی نرفت. وندرین خانه به جز آن حی نرفت. The difference is that ever since Abraham constructed Kaaba, God never visited that house. However, God once entered my heart and he has not left ever since. He is right here. God does not reside in a piece of stone. God resides in the heart of his lovers. This story is consciously, it is an exaggeration to make a point. This story simply illustrates a tremendous insight. God the infinite, who cannot fit in the universe, can fit in the heart of a human being. That's the moral of this story. God the infinite does not fit in the universe. The universe is not big enough to contain and hold God. The human heart, on the other hand, is capable of housing God. This basically goes to show the infinite potential of the human soul for growth. I truly don't know who the author of this passage is, but it could have been written by a Muslim mystic. And I'm going to share it with you to basically summarize this section of the importance of heart in spiritual development and growth. The passage really is talking about the search for God, quest for God. And this person was on a hunt for God, on a quest to find God. I looked for him in churches and cathedrals, but no, he wasn't there. I hunted him in the temples of Shiva, of Krishna, of Kali, but no sign of him did I find. I searched the pagodas and peered into the eyes of the stone Buddha. There was no evidence he had been there. I peeked into the mosques and minarets of Islam and kissed the sacred Kaaba, but no, he wasn't there either. Finally, I peered into my own heart, and there he was, hiding behind my desires. He had been there all the time, and he was smiling at me. Let me talk about a second important principle of mysticism, which has to do with the engine of faith. Is it fear or love? What type of force would help us turn to God? Is it the specter of a horrible punishment or the promise of a lofty reward that can help us get closer to God and follow his commands? This is a very fundamental question that theologians have grappled with. Let me begin by saying that fear is a very potent force to get human beings to act. It's a very potent force. Fear works very well with kids. Those of you who are parents know how potent this force is. I have to say that fear works very well in politics as well. If you want to get the voters to vote the way you want, I submit to you the best way to do it is to frighten them, scare them, and they will definitely seek refuge in you to give them shelter and help them out. It works in politics. In religions, fear sometimes works as well. I can even say that historically, fear of punishment and burning in eternal hell has been the norm in promoting adherence to all religions. Muslims have done it, Christians, Jews, and so on and so forth. Mystics, however, argue that fear is really not going to work when it comes to getting closer to God, to realizing God, to living in God. It's not the right mechanism to employ if you want to get closer to God. Mystics would say that fear may be a potent force for achieving a desired objective in some endeavors. However, fear is not a good force in endeavors that require dedication or devotion. Any endeavor, and I want to underscore, any endeavor that requires devotion, commitment, and dedication, you should never rely on fear in those endeavors. Who has ever won the Nobel Prize in mathematics, physics, and medicine out of fear? Who has ever won an Olympic gold medal out of fear? Who has ever invented a high-tech gadget out of fear? The answer to all these questions is none. Those are all possible when a heart is filled with love for a cause. You must love what you do if you want to succeed in it. Those who do well in business, those who do well in the academia, are the ones whose hearts are sold into a cause. Basically, religion, spiritual quest, and faith is no exception. If you want to succeed in your spiritual quest and your faith, you better love the cause that you have. Fear is not going to work there. Now, let's consider the Quran as a revealed text and see what it has to say about the engine of faith. Many Muslims incorrectly argue that the Quran promotes fear as an effective force to make us turn to God and do good deeds. Why would they make this claim? Why would they say that fear is preached by the Quran? Well, they point to quite a few verses in the Quran that refer to khawf. Khawf is an Arabic term and is repeatedly used and referred to in the Quran. Chapter 79, verses 40 and 41. وَأَمَّا مَنْ خَافَ مَقَامَ رَبِّهِ وَنَهْيَ النَّفْسَ عَنِ الْحَوَى فَإِنَّ الْجَنَّةَ هِيَ الْمَأْوَى. As for the one who reverenced the majesty of his Lord and enjoined the self from sinful lust, paradise would be the abode. Here, the Quran uses the term فَأَمَّا مَنْ خَافَ مَقَامَ رَبِّهِ. Intentionally, I used the term reverence to equate to khawf. However, khawf is often translated as fear into English. Most translations of the Quran, they translate khawf as fear into English. I submit to you that this is an inaccurate account of what the Quran has in mind. Let me explain for a few minutes. Fear rests on timidity and cowardice. Somebody who is fearful of something is timid. Fear is a psychological reaction to the unknown. Imagine for a sec that you enter your house and there is no electricity. The house is very, very dark. Most of us will be fearful to enter the house. It is the exact same house that we always enter and we always sleep at. Nonetheless, when it is absolutely dark, we have this native fear to enter our own house. Why? It's not that we are afraid of the house, we are afraid of the unknown. We don't know what may be waiting for us in the dark. Fear basically rests on the unknown. In other words, fear is mixed with ignorance. When we are ignorant about something, we're going to be fearful of it. Khawf, on the other hand, incorporates an element of awe, as in awesome. Khawf, in the Quranic sense of the term, incorporates awe. It is a psychological state rooted in deep awareness. It is the exact opposite of fear. Awe doesn't mean that you are frightened of something. Let me give you some examples. How many of you have been to the Niagara Falls or you have seen Mount Everest? You are standing far away from the falls, yet something envelops you. You have a unique experience. You are overwhelmed by what you see. You are not afraid that the Niagara Falls might fall on your head and you would die. We know better than that. We are far away from the falls. Nonetheless, as soon as we encounter this awesome sight, we are overwhelmed by this experience that we have. And that's what exactly khawf is all about. Why is it that the Quran time and again refers to khawf so much? There is a good reason. Let me give you the reason for it. We mortals tend to forget our inherent limitations and frailty. The younger we are, the more ignorant we are of our frailty and limitations. That's why young people would sit in a car and speed without knowing of the consequences. They say, I'm not afraid. My mom and dad are, but I'm not. Right? Because they are not. They think they are invincible. It is an illusion that they have. It's the illusion of invincibility which can be deadly. Now, some of us, even when we are in old age, we still have these illusions. Have you ever hang around very, very rich people? That's exactly how they behave. The snobbiness that goes with being rich has to do with this illusion that people may have that they are invincible. Because just because I have a ton of money, I can buy cures. Just because I have money, I can live forever. But God has a sobering news for us. No, you are not invincible. It doesn't matter how high you reach, how much money you have, you are still extremely frail, you are extremely vulnerable, you are very limited in your capabilities. There are experiences, however, in life that drive this point home to us. There are experiences that teach us how frail we are. One of them can be an experience of a serious illness. We are riding high and one day we cannot sleep very well and we talk to our doctor and he says, you know what, you've got cancer. As soon as this piece of news is given to you, the whole world basically crumbles on you. If we ever have a near-death experience, you are in a car crash, have you seen how shaken you are? It doesn't matter whether you have a PhD from Yale. It doesn't matter whether you are Bill Gates and you have $48 trillion. Does not matter. You are in a car crash, you're going to be shaken. And let me correct myself. Not that you're shaken. Your illusions will be shaken. For the first time in your life, you will see frailty. You will see your limitations face to face. Let me take a detour. Do you know why in all religions of the world, death is reminded a lot to people? It's not that, you know, these religions want us to make us miserable, that they want to make us depressed. It has nothing to do with that. Death is one of the two obstacles we can never, ever overcome. It doesn't matter who you are. Once you approach the gate of death, you have to bend. You cannot escape from that. Even when the Quran says, "Fi burujin mushayyada," even if you are hiding in castles on high, death will find you. The reason these verses are mentioned in the Quran again is not to make you depressed. Is to remind you of an eventuality. Learn about it. What do you think the second insurmountable obstacle is for us? Can you guess? God. God and death are the only two things we can never overcome. And that's why in all religions of the world, remembrance of God and death after life always go hand in hand. Tawheed wa ma'ad. You always have that in all religions of the world. Why? Because both of these experiences, the experience of an encounter with God and death, serve a very, very important function. It gives us the ability to manage our ego. We all tend to have very enlarged egos. Our egos sometimes are so huge, we cannot ever see anybody else. That's why we trample over everybody else, because we can't see them. Our ego has blinded us. Death and God remind us that no matter who you are, you will have to succumb to these truths. Going back to the notion of khawf. Khawf, or this immense experience that we have when we encounter the infinite God, reminds us how insignificant we are in the grand scheme of things. In the cosmic org chart, we are really, really insignificant. None of us really matter on that scale. The experience of the divine, this awesome experience that we have when we encounter the infinite, gives us a very delicious fruit. You know what that is? Modesty. Modesty. So, in a sense, khawf is a panacea for arrogance and enlarged ego. We typically think that only the people who are very weak turn to religion. That's exactly the argument of Sigmund Freud. Those who are weak, those who are ignorant, those who don't know, they embrace religion, right? Check this verse in the Quran. It says the exact opposite. Chapter 35, verse 28. إِنَّمَا يَخْشِيَ اللَّهَ مِنْ عِبَادِهِ الْعُلَمَاءِ. The people who truly reverence God are those who are knowledgeable. Those who are knowledgeable can truly appreciate the reverence of God. Mystic is one who deeply understands his situation relative to God. He has a deep appreciation of who he is. He fully comprehends who God is. He fully comprehends God's splendor, magnificence, and glory. Yet, the mystic is also assured that despite his glory, his grandeur and magnificence, God is also compassionate. God is also kind, merciful, and full of love for his creation. Perhaps one of the most beautiful portrayals of God in the Quran is in chapter 36. Chapter 36, verse 11. إنما تنذر من اتبع الذكر وخشي الرحمن بالغيب فبشره بمغفرة وأجر كريم. O Muhammad, you will be heeded only by those who uphold this message and reverence the Most Gracious even when they are alone in their privacy. Give them good news of forgiveness and a generous reward. The critical term in this verse is khashya rahman. Absolutely amazing construct. It really manages to bring Christianity and Judaism together. Let me spend a few minutes on that. Khashya means reverence, ar-rahman means merciful. Reverence and mercy united in one entity. In the Old Testament, basically God is portrayed as an awesome Lord. Yahweh, the Jewish Lord, strikes fear in the heart of his opponents. The God of the New Testament is not like that at all. The God of the New Testament is the God of mercy, love, and compassion. What seems to be irreconcilable in the Bible is reconciled in the Quran. Khashya Rahman, the one who imparts reverence, glory, magnificence, and awesomeness on us, that same entity is lovable, is merciful, and is compassionate. That's how the Old and the New Testament come together in the Holy Quran. The mystic understands that he is in the presence of the awesome Lord, so he behaves. He does not transgress. He does not go over the limits and the boundaries. And at the same time, the mystic is assured that this same powerful, awesome, magnificent God does not use his power as an abuse, but as a force to nourish his creatures. That's the assurance that the mystic has. Perhaps the story of Moses and his initial encounter with God in the Quran is very illuminating in this respect. When Moses approached the burning bush, suddenly a voice came to him. The voice instructed Moses to reach into his pocket. Moses did. And when he pulled his hand out, there was a blinding light in the palm of his hand. Then immediately the voice asks Moses to drop his wooden rod. Moses drops his rod, and suddenly the rod turns into a dragon. That's as much as Moses can take. Now remember, it is the voice that instructs Moses to drop the rod turns into a dragon. Moses runs away. As soon as he starts to run away, the voice comes back. The voice suddenly addresses Moses, Ya Musa, la takhaf. Ya Musa, la takhaf. Inni la yakhafu ladayyal mursalun. O Moses, fear not in my presence. My messengers shall not fear. Let me tell you something. God is toying with Moses, isn't he? He frightens Moses. He is the one who asks him to drop his rod, knowing that Moses is going to run away. It is counterintuitive. Why does God do that? Very simple. To grab the attention of Moses. To grab his undivided attention. There should be no distraction when you are in the presence of God. No interference should be there. Every day when we want to meet God, the meeting takes place amongst a zillion other distractions all around us. Our job, our family, the 5,000 TV channels we have, the million or so DVD and videos that we have, all of these compete with God. Undivided attention. That's what happened on Mount Sinai. There should be no interference, nothing to distract you from the Lord. And perhaps Rumi said it the best, لا تخفدن چخوفت داد حق نان فرستد چون فرستادت طبق. God scares the fearless ignorant who does not observe their limits and transgress. Yet as soon as scare settles in, God says, don't be frightened. See, the point is not to make us frightened. The point is to make us tune in, to make us have our undivided attention to what God has to say. Now, let me read you a poem from Hafez, and the way he experiences God. گرچه می گفت که زارت بکشم می دیدم که نهانش نظری با من دل سوخته بود. It's beautiful. Hafez likens God to a lion. He says, when I encountered God, when I experienced God, it was as if I was captive to a lion. I was captive under the claws of a lion. That's the awesomeness of God. I was unable to do anything. See, when a poor animal is captive in the claws of a lion, the harder he moves, the more he's going to get hurt. The best thing to do is do nothing and hope that the lion would let go. That's the best you can do. So Hafez says, that's exactly how I encountered God. He could shed my blood, yet he sent a signal to me not to be afraid of his overwhelming power and status. Not to be afraid. I am not going to use my power to hurt you. I'm going to use my power to nurture you. And that is the beauty of this verse in the Quran. God's grandeur and majesty makes him sometimes very remote and inaccessible. God the infinite, man the finite. How can the finite man relate to this infinite God? Next to impossible. Ordinarily, it is very difficult to connect to the infinite. We cannot relate to infinity. Somehow, the infinite must be reduced to a finite if we want to relate to him. That's what Jesus Christ is all about. When Christians say Christ was God embodied in the human form, that's exactly what they're saying. In other words, what they're saying is that God, in so long as he is infinite, we cannot relate to him. Somehow God has to become finite for us to relate to this infinite. Anyhow, that same infinite, awesome, magnificent, glorious God instructs us in the Holy Quran, وَإِذَا سَأَلَكَ عِبَادِي أَنِّي فَإِنِّي قَرِيبٌ. When my servants ask you about me, indeed I am very close. Qareeb in English means near or close. The question is, how close? The Quran teaches us, وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ حَبْلِ الْوَرِيدِ. We are closer to human than his jugular vein. That's how close this remote and inaccessible God is to us. Now finally, the Quran instructs us of a special relationship that can exist between God and man. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا مَنْ يَرْتَدَّ مِنْكُمْ عَنْ دِينِهِ فَسَوْفَ يَأْتِيَ اللَّهُ بِقَوْمٍ يُحِبُّهُمْ وَيُحِبُّونَهُ. O you who have faith, if you revert from your religion, then God will substitute in your place people whom he will love, and they will love him back. Did you notice the verse starts with the notion of the faithful and ends with love? It basically teaches us what faith should rest upon. It is love. Hope, that the Quran uses, when you translate it into Arabic, it is love, right? The Quran teaches us that love is the special relationship that can exist between God and the faithful. Love is the bond or the glue that connects God with the faithful. Those who turn their back to faith, the bond between them and God has weakened. The perception that God is the beloved and man is the lover is common to both Islam and Christianity. And inshallah, I will dedicate a lecture in the future to the commonalities between Islam and Christianity when it comes to the notion of love. The next important principle in mysticism, existential transformation, that is the essence of religiosity. spiritual development basically means acquiring divine identity, or as mystics would say, unite with God. That is the ultimate goal of religion, to unite with God. In Jewish Kabbalah, this phenomenon is called unification with God. Sufis call it annihilation or fana. Buddhists call it God realization. In all cases, what they have in mind is a spiritual and existential transformation that should take place in a person. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, once instructed Muslims, "Mutu qabla an tamutu," die before you die. Obviously, Prophet Muhammad is not instructing us to commit suicide. Prophet Muhammad is not instructing us to ponder the physical death at this point. Rather, he was inviting Muslims to undertake an existential experience that ultimately would lead to a radical shift in their awareness, a radical shift and transformation of character. And at the core of this transformation, there lies an intense desire to be in harmony with God, to attune our will to God's will. In other words, Prophet Muhammad is instructing us to be like a snake. When he sheds his skin and develops a new one, that's precisely what Prophet Muhammad wants us to do, to shed our old identity and acquire a new one, to shed our sinful character and develop a new one. What does God realization mean, which is at the core of this spiritual transformation? What does it mean? Let me spend a few minutes talking about it. Let me use Islamic references to elaborate on God realization. Typically, you see, whenever Muslims do a good deed or they do an act of charity, they usually follow that with a phrase, Qurbatan ilallah. I did this act of charity in order to get closer to God. I didn't do it with the intention of helping a poor person. That was not my intention. My intention was to get closer to God. The fact that a poor person benefited from my act of charity is coincidental. It is a byproduct of my desire to get closer to God, to approach God. The desire to turn to God basically implies that we intend to cultivate an inner attitude of surrender and openness to God. To turn to God implies turning to godly values. What are some of the godly values that we have? Mercy, compassion, beauty, justice, truth. These are all godly values. Putting God and all He represents at the center of our lives. This means rethinking our priorities and reallocating our energies and our most valuable asset, which is our life. Now, according to the mystics, Islam is a path that takes us and makes us progress towards God realization. Mystics liken Islam to a path. What is a path good for? The path is good for making a journey, to make a trip. The journey that Muslims are supposed to make is really an internal one. It's a migration. Migration from one state of existence into another one. From a state in which God and godly values are absent into a state in which God fills our outlook, character, and life. This is what this journey and this migration is all about. Those who successfully complete this journey, as the Quran says, they will become Waliullah, Waliullah, an ally of God, a friend of God. You want to be an ally of God? You want to befriend God? You must be able to successfully complete this journey from yourself to Him. You should be able to transcend your ego and reach out to Him. If you can successfully complete this journey, you will become Waliullah. In other words, you will become a reflection of God. That is exactly what Christians mean when they say Jesus Christ was God Himself. In other words, it is a metaphor. Don't take it literally. It means that Jesus Christ had gained the ability to reflect God. When mystics such as Hallaj say An-al-Haq, this is exactly what they mean. In other words, they become a reflection of God. They will become a conduit for God's will. They will become an instrument in God's service to realize His aims. In Islam's oral tradition, there is a saying attributed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Prophet Muhammad had a vision of God telling him. So here, God is talking to Prophet Muhammad, quote, "When I, God, love a servant, I will become his ear through which he hears. I will become his eye with which he sees, his hand with which he grasps, and his foot with which he walks." In other words, God will fill our character, God will fill our motivations, our aspirations, and our priorities in life. This is what godliness is all about. God basically takes over the servant and uses the servant as a conduit to fulfill his own wishes. As Saint Francis, the famous Christian mystic, once wished, "O Lord, make me the instrument of thy peace. O Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace." This is what an ally of God wishes, to reach a state of existence that he can become an instrument for the will and the design of the Lord. Saint Francis wishes that wherever he goes, whatever he touches, it will spell peace and harmony, not conflict and hatred. According to a Sufi story, one day a few Hebrews went to Moses and said, "Moses, you talk to God. Please tell him that we want to invite him to dinner." Moses obviously got very angry. He said that God does not eat or come to dinner parties. What an idiotic idea is it that you Hebrews have? The next time Moses went to Mount Sinai to talk to God, God said to him, "Moses, why didn't you inform me of my dinner invitation from my servants?" Moses said, "But my Lord, you do not eat. You do not answer foolish invitations like this." God replied, "Keep what you know between you and me. Tell them that I will come in answer to their invitation." So Moses came down from Mount Sinai and announced that God was coming to dinner after all. Of course, everybody got busy preparing an incredible feast for God, including Moses himself. They wanted to prepare their best dish for God. While they were cooking, an old man unexpectedly showed up. He was poor and hungry, so he asked for something to eat. The busy cooks said, "No, no, we are all waiting for God. When God comes, we will all eat together." "Why don't you make yourself useful," they told the poor person, "and help fetch water from the well." They gave nothing to the poor person to eat. Time passed and God did not show up. Moses became terribly embarrassed. He didn't know what to tell the folks. The next day again, Moses went back up to Mount Sinai to talk to God. He said, "God, what are you doing to me? I am trying so hard to convince everybody that you exist. You said you would come to our feast and then you never showed up. Nobody is going to believe me from now on." God replied, "Moses, I did come. If you had fed my poor servant, you would have fed me." In other words, God appeared in the person and in the form of the poor person. God said, "I who cannot fit into all the universes, fit into the heart of my believing servant. When you serve one of God's servants, you serve God." So the general principle in mysticism is that when you serve the created, you serve the Creator. I'm running really late and I want to stop right now. I hope that this brief introduction sheds some light on the essentials of the mystical perspective on religion. Mystics have safeguarded the core spiritual and ethical teachings of great religions for us. Through ages, authentic mystics have been the beacons of spiritual development and ethical behavior. We need to keep this tradition alive and prosperous. Thank you very much for your attention, and God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.